Welcome to this talk on robots for fun and research today. You might be wondering, what the hell is a robotics talk doing on a hacker conference? So I moved from hacking to research a long time ago already, and I'm using robots to also as tools to find out about human intelligence, about intelligent behavior by humans and animals, and I think that's a nice connection to chaos and hacking. So this talk will be about some recent development in robotics. I'm not going to talk about industrial robotics. It's more about robots for scientific research fields like biology or psychology. And, well, please ask any questions if anything is unclear during the talk, but there will also be a question session at the end. So to make a short outline, here are some Sony iBooks, but this is not a promotion for Sony. And actually, if you want to hear something interesting about the naughty things that Sony did this year, just in an hour there's a talk by Fukami in room 4 about the Sony rootkit. So I'm going to start with giving a short overview on the history of robotics. Then I'll show you some, I picked out some specific research issues in robotics. We will see the social issues of robotics, what is robot hardware hacking, and of course, can't be missing here, some security issues with modern robots, and we're going to ask what's going to happen in the future. So starting with a short history of robots in artificial intelligence, some people say it's starting much earlier with Da Vinci, who already built intelligent machines. But let's start in the 18th century. There were some early animated machines, for example, the automated duck by Vaucanson. He was a monk in France, and he built this duck, this machine, who could even drink, eat, and shit. And the chief of the monastery didn't like it so much, so he was thrown out of it, but he continued building robots. And then a few years later, actually only the term we have today, robot, was coined by Karel Čapek, a Czech guy. And robot came originally from the word for worker or hard labor in Czech, meaning robota. And if you know the German word for work, which is Arbeit, and you remove the vowels, you can still see it's very similar to robot, Arbeit and robot. And of course, everybody or most of you know Asimov's laws of robotics. If you've seen, they recently showed up in a movie about his novel in I, Robot. So meaning that a robot shouldn't injure a human being and so on and so forth, you know that. Then in the 1940s, 50s, you see here on the left an example of early, quite advanced robotics. These are Gray Walter's turtles in English, and they're called Elsie and Elmer, and they've been built completely in analog hardware, but had already some complicated interaction behavior. People interpreted their behavior even as emotional. The two robots were moving around each other and they said, oh, these robots are in love, these robots are performing a dance, and things like that. And that was already in the 1940s. And from that on, everything was going downhill again. So only in 69, we had the first autonomous robot of our time, which was Shaky from Stanford, California. This robot could autonomously navigate around obstacles with about, I think, 1 meter per 7 minutes or so. So it was just incredibly slow. Then later in the 1980s, we were going back to really behavior-based robots, which Gray Walter did already in the late 40s. This was a discipline founded by Rodney Brooks from MIT. And so we were also looking really at reactive robots. So robot was only reacting at the environment and didn't have internally any representation or any brain. This changed the last, let's say, 20 years a bit when the event of entertainment robots started, because then with entertainment robots, people wanted to have something interesting. They wanted to have robots who really did something, who really showed intelligence, and then there was no point in doing either the very easy, just reactive thing, or just putting a very complicated brain and old AI stuff into a robot. And then people were thinking that, giving this example here, about the importance of embodiment. So they were saying, it's not really possible to have intelligence without having a body. And it's all about having senses and actuators and having perception of the world. And a big philosophical discussion came up when Deep Blue was beating the world champion in chess, Kasparov, in, I think it was 1998. And before, people were saying, oh, intelligent machines, intelligence robot doesn't really exist. But then this event happened, and people said, so what? It beat the guy in chess, but it doesn't really change anything. So maybe true intelligence in robots can be more seen in robots playing football, for example. So it's much more complicated than beating a human being in chess, than beating a human football team. This continued. We can skip that slide. How can we use robots as research tools? And why do we want to use robots as research tools? So there's several examples or several good reasons for doing that. First, the robots have reproducible behavior in comparison to animals, to doing experiment on animals to find out about animal behavior, animal intelligence. Second, the internal states, they can be accessed very easily. And the third point, the robots survive most of the experiments. Most. So if we want to combine the field robotics and biology, that's called biorobotics. And we call that understanding by building. And these are the methods that are used. Well, this is a roboticist who wants to build a robot who does the behavior of an ant. So by first building a model of the natural agent, which could be either a simulation or a real robot, then we can abstract general principles of intelligence and apply these general principles to the design of intelligent devices. And then we look at the intelligent device and go into a loop and repeat the whole thing until we're satisfied with our machine. So staying with the example of a roboticist wanting to build a desert ant, I just show some short example of a project we had together with some biologists in Zurich. They were studying the desert ant cataglyphus for over 20 years, and this desert ant has one speciality. It lives in the Tunisian desert, and doesn't lay pheromone trails as the European and German and Berlin ants do. So normal ants, they leave these pheromone trails and then they can easily navigate around these trails. But in the Tunisian desert, the pheromones do evaporate very quickly. So these ants had to evolve to use different strategies than that one. And they can navigate for about 200 meters and then find back to their nest, which is just as small little hole in the desert ground, so they have to navigate really exactly. And the biologists, they had several theories or assumptions how this tiny little ant can do that. And we thought, well, we're going to test this with some robots. So we went also into the Tunisian desert with this robot here called Zahabot, and tested some of these navigation strategies or hypotheses the biologists came up. This one is called the snapshot model. So they said the ant is taking a omnidirectional snapshot at a nest, storing that, then going away from the nest, and again taking a snapshot, and comparing these two snapshots to find a vector which is pointing back to the nest. So that was the theory of the biologists. And we built this model into a robot and tested it under the same conditions. I can show a quick movie here of Sahabat in the Tunisian desert. So that was the field. It was very flat and hardly any landmarks, just these cylinders. The robot was driven manually out of the field, away from the nest. It already took a snapshot in the middle of the nest, of the field. And roughly around that point, the robot is put into autonomous mode and is told to apply the snapshot model to navigate back to the nest. So now the robot is navigating autonomously. And in fact, the robot is driving back to the position where it started. So we kind of confirmed it, that the model is sort of working. And there was another hypothesis about these navigation strategies called the ALV model. And a colleague of mine, Ralf Möller, from the iLab, who is now at Bielefeld, built this robot completely with analog hardware. So that's also quite interesting because here you don't have the separation between the body and the brain anymore. And this robot was built to use the ALV model to navigate back to the home position, exactly the same method than the arms were supposedly doing that. So we can see here in the video, the robot is put in this area, it's taking a snapshot, then it's replaced, and very quickly driving back to the original position. So that movie is double speed, by the way. So now the interesting thing came. The two examples before, we hard-coded the models into the robots. So now we were interested whether the robot was also able to learn one of these models or maybe a different model. And we designed different neural networks. If you've been in the talk yesterday about machine learning, maybe that's kind of similar. So the robot was put into a room and was just exploring the room for 5 minutes, always taking snapshots, and always feeding these snapshots into the neural network. Always two connected snapshots. And as the desired result, we had the direction of the line connecting the two positions where these snapshots have been taken. And after this exploration tour of around 5 minutes, the weights of the neural network, they converged, they've been learned, and we could use that neural network as a way of having the robot navigate autonomously and having learned this navigation strategy. And in fact, it worked. So the robot only took 5 minutes to learn a general model of navigation in any environment. In fact, we could learn it in one room, take the robot in a different room, and it could apply the learned model there. So it was completely generalized. So one of the results is that the visual homing was possible. You see here the angle error of the homing vector. The angle error is just the angle between the real direction and the direction the robot was taking. And you see it's still quite high, but it goes, after a few minutes, it goes below 90 degrees. And as you can imagine, if you have an error which is always smaller than 90 degrees, then you will end up in a finite time at your goal position, right? Is it clear? Okay. And what was also nice that it turned out that they learned a homing strategy. So when we examined the weights of the neural network, turned out to be exactly the ALV model, which was implemented on the analog robot. So we really confirmed that that this model wasn't only possible for the ant with very few neurons, but also that this model can be easily learned just by doing exploration tours. Okay, so much for the experiments in biology with navigation. I'm just showing a different project, also from the University of Zurich. It was called Artificial Mouse Project, and we were interested in the sensory modality of the whiskers of a mouse. You can see on the left a mouse with the whiskers, and the information of these whiskers is directly mapped into the brain, into the cortex of the rat. So here, this is an image, just a picture of the cortex of the rat, and each of these barrels represents the data of one whisker. So they're clearly separated. It's quite nice. And we modified this small Capera robot to have omnidirectional vision and to have two arrays with whiskers. And actually, we tried out different materials, and it turned out that a real rat whiskers had the best damping properties. So we were actually using real rat whiskers on our robot. And if you want to find more information, there's the URL where you can find more about AMOS. Okay, so these two examples we just saw were more inspired from biology, or were more giving feedback to biology. Now, this looks very colorful, but this is about developmental robotics. And here we were working closely together with psychologists who study the development of young children. And it's a very young field, but it's very interesting because, of course, our experiments with the robot are very different than the experiments the psychologists can make with young children, you can imagine. And one of the examples were the challenges of joint attention. And we were studying interaction behavior of these robots. We were using these AIBO robots. You can see one here on the front. They have many degrees of freedom. They have a camera. They have microphones. So they're quite useful robotic tools. And you don't have to repair them all the time, as I had with my previous robots. And so we were studying interaction and communication. And here we were really studying the communication as humans or young children do. So, of course, these robots, they also have wireless LAN, and we weren't studying the TCP/IP communication, but communication with gestures, communication with voice, and so on. And in a different experiment, we studied how development can be open-ended. So how can a robot learn something in a continuous way without being told to learn something? So the problem usually in robotics was that, okay, you had this humanoid robot, you could teach the robot to climb stairs, but then the only thing the robot could do is climbing stairs and nothing else. And we wanted to circumvent this problem by having a robot starting really at the stage of a young child, putting it in the environment, and then having the robot continuously learn and not really telling him what to learn. So we called it a playground experiment, and we were using this funny playmat for kids just to be comparable with the experiments the psychologists made. And we put the robot into this environment, and it could do different things like bashing the smiley, bite into the elephant's ear, and things like that. And all that time, what we taught the robot was it should make predictions about the consequences of its actions. The actions were, for example, this biting and bashing movement, And the predictions were the sensory inputs, for example, what the robot was hearing, what the robot was seeing, and so on. And this experiment was running for several hours, and the actions the robot was choosing to do were based on the largest learning progress. That was also kind of put into the robot as a drive. So the robot chose the action with which he thought the he could learn the most. That's quite interesting, and we will see on the video what's going to happen. That's the video of one experiment. The robot is trying to do different things here. For example, bashing its arm. And the actions, they were not fixed, so he could bash with a variable angle, with a variable strength, and so on. So it was really a big parameter space. And was always learning to predict the consequences of its actions. And what we could observe is that the robot, for example, after an hour, the robot was just looking around and not doing the bashing and the biting, because he noticed that looking is very easy, and looking, his progress level went very steeply high when doing just the looking. And then after a while, the robot switched to a different behavior, because then he completely learned to predict what's going to happen if he just looks around. And the progress curve became flat again, was quite high, but became flat again. And then the robot switched to a more and more complicated behavior, and so on and so on. And it wasn't really... So the robots are also making sounds and trying to get feedback from the other robot. That's also one thing you can learn. So we really try to provide a quite rich environment where you could do many things. And the only the only restriction here was that we kind of paralyzed the hind legs, because we didn't want the robot to fall off our area, because then we would have problems. But that was one of the only restrictions we made. Did he bite the elephant's ear already? No? Okay, there's also more information about this project on this URL. So these were basically the more scientific experiment I showed, just to give you an idea of what's happening during the last 5 years in robotics. Just a few examples. Of course, there's much more going on. Now I want to switch to a different topic, which is robots as tools. And there's a much more practical approach today about robots. Here you see on the right, Roomba, which is a robotic hoover. And I don't have one, but I heard it's working quite nicely. I don't know, anybody have made any experience? No one with a Roomba? Okay. And so today we don't really find a universal household robot anymore. We're not looking for that. We're not looking for a humanoid robot who's hoovering the floor and cleaning the kitchen and maybe giving you a full body massage. We're more looking into specific tools, like having this small robot who doesn't look really like a robot, who can hoover your floor, and having other robots, I don't know. And the third point is that hardware prices are falling, of course. That makes robots much more present in everyday's households. So here the same thing is happening, like in computers, everybody can afford. That changed really the market of computers when everybody could afford to have one at home. And now the same thing is happening with robots. And another interesting market is also entertainment robots. I think a really good example is the Tamagotchi. It's not a real robot, but it has this idea. And it's amazing. Sold 13 million times just in 1 year, and it couldn't do anything useful. So it was just annoying, it was dying, it was feeling ill, and it only had disadvantages, but people really wanted that. And also the Furbies, every second of you has a Furby at home, or had a Furby at home. Those were also really annoying, making strange noises. They were actually repeating things that people were saying. So I heard that at the CIA headquarters, they didn't allow any Furbies anymore, because if people took them back, they were just repeating the discussions there, and that wasn't so nice. Another example of entertainment robots, which weren't actually robots but also simulation, is this computer game called Creatures, which was the first computer game to have some kind of real artificial life, which is a contradiction, I guess, built by CyberLife Technologies in Cambridge. In Creatures, you had these little nouns who could learn to talk, who could manipulate objects. And the interesting thing here, the game was that two nouns could actually reproduce, and the new nouns that was created had some properties of the parents, and they had a real artificial hormonal system, and so on. And unfortunately, that was Creatures 1, which was really successful. Then they built Creatures 2, which was more complicated, but there wasn't anymore really the control what's going to happen. So the nouns were able to form quasi full sentences, but after a while, unfortunately, after the program was sold, they found out that in many situations the nouns were kind of getting depressed. In this artificial world, you have objects, you have fruits, you have dangerous objects like poisonous fruits. And the nouns, they started to throw themselves into the water and eat poisonous fruits. 2 years later, CyberLife Technologies went bankrupt. But what you really think about when you're talking about entertainment robots are probably something like these three here, the Aibo and the Curio from Sony. That Curio was the first robot who was able to run. Running means having not always one foot on the floor. And Asimo from Honda. But these humanoids, they were mainly used as mascots for the company. So you couldn't actually buy them. They're mainly representing the company and saying, hey, look what cool things we can build, but they weren't doing much apart from greeting and walking around. But there was one guy who probably all of you know who was very early in his time about thinking in about entertainment robots. That was Douglas Adams. And in 1979 already, if you look into the Encyclopedia Galactica, it defines a robot as a mechanical apparatus designed to do the work of a man. The marketing division of the Sirius Cybernetics Corporation defines a robot as your plastic pal who's fun to be with. That's an entertainment robot. So there are some more issues about entertainment robots which are interesting. One is about emotional attachment. So for example, you buy many tools, and if you see this gadget from a different company and it's better, you buy this other thing. But you don't do that with a pet. You don't sell your dog just because you see a better or bigger dog somewhere. And the idea is to do the same with entertainment robots. So you should build up some kind of emotional relationship with, for example, your Aibo. Give him a name and call him and not it, like I'm already doing. And so you're not so easily throwing it away. So you're staying interested much longer. And it's not so important, the functionality is not really important. It's important that the toy stays, or the robot stays interesting. For example, there's a new development what this robot can do. Now it can play MP3s and you can listen to web radio. And I personally don't think that's a good idea, because you don't want to have an MP3 player who's walking out of the room. And it's quite big. You don't need that. So I think it was better if the robot is just doing nice things, is being cute, and then that it would sell much better. But anyway, they decided now to have it as a walking MP3 player. For that to stay interesting, it must be able to learn, must be adaptive and unpredictable, and... And of course, design issues are also important. You want it to look nice. That's the success of an iPod, for example. It's maybe more expensive, but it looks nice, and well, you will buy it. Just a quick overview on robots in films. We already had a nice talk last night by Constanze. Seeing some robots and biometric devices. You can see here also in these films that there's a big difference between the Western and the Eastern image of robots. So in most of these Western films, robots are something evil, robots are something dangerous. And that's not so much the case in Japan, for example. So there are two very different views. So you can see on the left, there's Japan. They built most of the robots we see today, like the Aibo, the Curio, Asimo. It all comes from Japan. And in the West, on the right, so that is Europe, but not only Europe, but also in the US, you have a different image of robotics. And already for quite a long time, for example, It started with the Golem in Prague. That was kind of a robot, and it was dangerous and evil. We had Frankenstein's Monster, which was kind of a robot and dangerous. And also the one other interpretation why Japanese people are more easygoing with robots is about the story about the creation of the world. So in our Western religions, the humans are created in two steps. So you build the human. God builds the human out of a piece of dirt, basically. That's the first step. But then there's a second step, and the second step is very important. And the second step is the divine breath, right? And only these two steps, only with these two steps, you can create life. And we have that in all our Western religions like that. But in the East, the two different gods. There were sisters, I think, Izanagi and Izanami, and everything was just appeared. So we didn't really have this creation in two steps. There was just a spontaneous generation. And so it's the Japanese people, maybe because of that tradition, maybe that's one of the reasons why they have a more easier approach to machines that behave like living beings. Okay, some example of robotic hardware hacks. So in recent days, it became quite trendy to buy some commercial robots and modify them. You already have seen one example, which is the artificial mouse, where we modified a Keperer robot by adding lots of different sensors, like a real red whiskers. So that's kind of not really a cyborg, but an animal robot mixture. Then, of course, Lego Mindstorms, they're built to be modified, and you can see in the area there, you can also join some nice robotics projects there, also programming Lego Mindstorms, build some new interfaces maybe, compatible for Linux. Then there are two examples which I want to show more into detail. One is the RoboSapien, built by Mark Tilden, which, if you've been here last year, you saw a talk about that. And the other one is some modification of some pet dogs. This is not an AIBO, by the way. So let's have a look at the examples of these dog hacks. So in Paris, I met an artist. She calls herself Sabadol. She's called France Cadet. And she modifies these dogs and does different things with them. So you can see on the right, you can see a whole different, whole sort of different robot modifications. Here, if you can see that, it's shown how it's done. So it's based on an iCybe, which you can get very cheaply on eBay, and adding a little bit of hardware, and then you can program them. And one of them is, for example, this is a mixture between a dog and a jellyfish, apparently. So it's glowing in the dark and makes some strange noises. Here we have a schizo dog, which is kind of obvious why it's called like that. And on the bottom here, you see a dog, which is actually a cow. And if I can show the video, what's the interesting thing about this? It's called Dolly, actually. These are all the different species they've exhibited in an exhibition.
Yes, mad cow disease, progeria, premature aging, abnormal size, and other various pathologies.
Okay, these were creations by France Cadet. I'm just going to show again RoboSapien. That's a robot that has been built by Mark Tilden. And he actually wanted people to hack this robot, to make hardware modifications. And one side by him is one quote by him is, a single screwdriver takes the RoboSapien completely apart, and inside everything is labeled, color-coded, and socketed for convenience. So that was really the idea of why he was building the robot. And I think the price was around 100 euros. If you bought it just like that, it was remote-controlled. But the chest of the robot was empty, so you could open it and put in your own things and wire it up and build an autonomous robot. And one example of someone who did that is an example of Sven Behnke from Freiburg, who gave a talk last year about it. He modified the RoboSapien with a PDA and a small camera and used it for RoboCup. And maybe I can also show a video of the movements of RoboSapien. Very efficient, but it's kind of working. Taking too long. Okay, that was RoboSapien. So much about robotic hardware hacks. There are lots more, but I think these are the interesting ones, the modified dogs and the modified RoboSapien. Just quickly at the end, I want to mention some security issues you might be thinking about which might arise with robotics. One, of course, is military robots. People started to build robots for the military, robots that went to Iraq. I don't think it's the state of the art is like that we can trust what's going to happen. I mean, computers crash, robots crash. It's just very dangerous what's going on there. And there are also these ideas about building robot swarms, which are tiny, thousands of tiny little robots equipped with cameras. So these are currently built. It's not working yet, but that will also throw in some new questions. And of course, even entertainment robots like the AIBO are posing some security and risks. So for example, with the new software here, I just read out what are the features of the software if you buy that thing commercially. Okay, it has wireless LAN, it has a video camera, it can read your emails, and it plays MP3s. So there are some problems with that, of course, as you can imagine. So the advertisement text here says, in Navigator, you can either remotely control or monitor AIBO while viewing the world through AIBO's camera. House-sitting mode allows you to record video from AIBO while you are away. In Player, AIBO can play your favorite music as a dancing speaker. Then the second thing is also interesting. In scheduler, Aibo will be synchronized with your Microsoft Outlook schedule, enabling Aibo to inform you of your appointments. In diary, Aibo will keep a diary with pictures of every day, and Aibo can both read the pages and upload them to a blog. So maybe you don't want your Aibo to put blogs about you on the internet, especially if you're running the whole day. I'm just trying to get a live camera image. I'm not sure whether it's working. So you can see the live camera image on the left. It's I'm not recording it, by the way. That's what I'm saying, yeah. And it's 30 frames per second. The quality is quite nice. So if you have this robot just in your flat or going to another room, you can easily Telnet to it, and or other people can easily Telnet to it and get a live video coverage. And well, some people probably don't like that. No, there's no protection. It's a Telnet, and it's normal. Yeah, it even has a web server. You can run an FTP server on it. So. Yeah, so some protection would be nice. You can see there little small problems. Okay, last slide. The future of robotics. Many people try to make predictions about the future of robotics. There's one statement which is quite interesting. It's that robots will beat the human world champions in soccer. When's that going to happen? In 2050. That's what the RoboCup mission statement says. So a real human team, and even the world champions, not just any football team. So yeah, I'm interested whether this will happen. And there were also some predictions when AI will reach human level. Several important people made some predictions about 5 years ago. These predictions were made. Rai Kurzweil is saying that will already happen in 2019, which is quite soon. Arthur C. Clarke is a bit, 1 year more pessimistic. He says 2020. And Hans Moravec makes a prediction for 2050. But that's already very, very brave. And, all the previous prediction failed. So we will see.
Do you sincerely believe that robots can ever reach the level of human beings with the intelligence and the recognition of things? And
well, I think it really depends on what you mean by human intelligence. For example, if the robot has a different morphology, different senses, different body than a human, you will never be able to compare the intelligence. But I think we're going in the right direction now with robotic learning, also with the experiments which are at the very beginning, which I showed on the playground experiment, that goes in the direction that robots really autonomously learn to do what they're physically able to do and without us programming them. So it's going in that direction, but I don't think they will be to be confused with humans. It's not like Terminator or anything like that. And well, the other question is whether we are cyborgs already, maybe. we have these artificial devices. We have, for example, we have glasses which are dependent on us, which are already part of our body. There are some crazy people who are doing crazy things, like here on the left you see a professor from England, Kevin Warwick. He implanted this chip into his arm and was trying to read the sensory data. One experiment was just an RFID chip. Then he was trying to read his own sensory data from his nerve cells. He also implanted a chip into the arm of his wife and tried to use the data that was censored in her body and apply it to his own senses. I'm not sure whether I should tell that. he was telling that he could see whether his wife had an orgasm or not, even remotely. So maybe there are better ways, but Kevin Warwick. And Stellark is quite famous. He's an Australian performance artist. Here on the film, on the picture, you can see Stellark with a third arm, and he was steering that arm also with different measurements of nerve cells. So he was using his normal two arms at the same time than his robotic arm. And maybe that's the future of robotics. And that's the end of my talk. Thank you. So maybe time for questions?
Is there something like a software development kit for this IBO thing, or can I even run Linux on it?
Okay. Yes, you can easily program the IBO. If you buy it, Sony provides a free software. It's a C++ API. And there comes a cross-compiler with it, and you can easily program the IBO yourself. And it's the same processor than the PlayStation, so it's not running Linux at the moment, but that would be a nice idea.
Having read a lot of Asimov, a lot of his texts, while robots are never usually destructive, there's a lot of problems with the people rioting and having other complaints and eventually rejecting robots altogether. Do you think that, because you've done some psychology, do you think that's going to be much of a problem? Do you think that there'll be much human resistance to it?
So the question was... Okay.
So the question was whether there will be much human resistance in the future about robots, or no? I don't see a danger. I think we just have to be very aware of it and discuss all the new issues, and then I don't see any real dangers. Okay, thank you very much.